Welcome to Talking and Walking, hosted by Andrew Stuck from Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. Talking Walking brings you interviews with people from the world of walking, artists, activists, professionals, and those of us who have a passion for just taking a walk. David Watson is an Australian photo media artist and writer intrigued by progress. In 2012, he completed Wild Ride, a doctorate fueled by the findings of a slow 6-year walking and swimming pilgrimage across suburban Sydney. He's always considered himself a street artist. First in London in the 80s, on weekends he would comb the London A to Z by bicycle with his trusty Olympus OM1, seeking out forgotten corners and layered textures. Latterly, he's been walking the streets through the suburbs of Sydney to capture memories. In 2005, feeling disconnected and remote from the local, he determined to walk west from his home in urban Rozelle, following the spine of Victoria Road, a major artery out of the city. Over 2 years and 19 walks, his path led inexorably to his childhood home in suburban Dundas, where his elderly parents had lived for 60 years, looking out to the Blue Mountains. Although less than 10 miles as the crow flies, David's serendipitous looping route covered perhaps 100 miles of concrete, bitumen and harbour shore. When he reached his destination, he chose to swim back along the Parramatta River to Sydney.
How are you using walking as part of your practice?
It's always a good question. Being in London gives me the opportunity to say my whole walking practice really began inadvertently in the 1980s in London, in Deptford, New Cross, where I had a mad friend who wanted to go on cycling journeys every weekend to the most extreme ends of the A to Z. So we went to every square over the years.
Wow.
Over about 5 or 6 years. Ended up in the most wonderful places. And being a photographer, that was, you know, music to my ears, to be in odd places with remarkable images and shapes and forms and lighting, of course. So in 2005, I decided to set off out my front door in Rozelle, which is about 3k from the centre of Sydney, and see what I could find. There were no preconceptions. I didn't know where I was headed, but over about 2 years and about 20 walks, my steps led eventually, and I guess this is predictable in retrospect, to my family home, which was about 30k away, but I took about 300k to get there.
Mm-hmm.
Did a lot of doubling back and winding around and heading down to the water, because of course Sydney's on a glorious harbour and the Parramatta River, which is part of that harbour. And hook and by crook, as I meandered my way west, I discovered all sorts of things at a slower pace, often sitting, thinking, reading, as well as walking, about my own suburban milieu, which actually began to make it seem rich and worthwhile to be living in. The Aboriginal history was something that was never spoken about when I went to school, and there are all sorts of remnant echoes.
Aboriginal, we always think of songlines and the whole that concept of oral walking and the pace and the place is so important.
Well, I can't help but think we all desire songlines, and quite often they're pretty obscured in the metropoli we inhabit. So yes, I probably was searching for that kind of richness that makes every step more worthwhile. And somehow, Andrew, after several years of following my nose, it began to turn into a PhD, and I had a most sympathetic and wonderful Australian artist called Anne Ferrin, who was my supervisor and encouraged me to pursue this idiosyncratic vision of my own country. So yes, it was kind of an assay of country, as the Aboriginal people call it. But my country was suburban. It was paved like the path we're walking on here in Greenwich, with bitumen.
Yeah.
And most of it was curbed and gutted.
Yeah.
It was also mostly covered with large garages and pools and affluent people.
Well, it's interesting because when I interviewed Ben Rossiter, who runs Victoria Walks, one of the things they talk about a lot in terms of health and the issues around health, the Australian suburb, they talk about the fat mile and the fact that you have to travel a long way to get to anything significant. The problem is the most significant thing you'll find is a fast food takeaway sort of drive-in. And pretty much little else.
I mean, Australia, as you would know, is famous for the quarter acre block. I think it was more like a half acre block in the old days. But our suburbs are very American. They're very spread out. And of course, that was all facilitated by cheap petrol in the early days. Increasingly, Sydneysiders, as with most urban metropoli, are realizing that you can't just go on expanding 30, 40, 50, 60, 70 kilometers because the poor people can't get to work. So yes, I think we're beginning to realise that some sort of urban consolidation has to happen. And of course we notice here in London where we've got two or three stories most of the time. And that itself leads to a richness, a layering. So I think that's where we're headed in Sydney as well.
You know, would you be described as an ethnographer? I mean, or an anthropologist? And were you taking photographs all the time?
I was taking photographs at most steps, yes. I took thousands of analog photographs of my OM1, my old Olympus. I started picking up all these objects, and they became actually more important than the fairly straight landscape photography I was doing on my route. So I made several exhibitions out of this detritus, and it was scanned and enlarged. But for instance, there was a suite of bottle tops, which looked, when blown up to my head size, remarkably like human beings. And small shards of plastic, which would look like marine craft, which suggested the histories of the Parramatta River, various colonial waves of maritime traffic. Or I was realising that by picking up things, you could evoke things which weren't photographable. Because that, of course, is one of the big problems with certainly analogue photography. If you go to photograph something which has disappeared, it's not easy.
Who are the most interesting characters you encounter? Because I mean, I remember myself from walking through some of the suburbs that you could walk for quite a long time and never meet anyone.
I did these walks when my children were still at school and I had to be home at 3:15. I said to someone recently, I haven't read much of the flaneur literature of any flaneur having to be home at 3:15 for the kids. But I certainly had to be. And the corollary of that was, of course, the streets were empty because these were all weekdays that I got to go on my walks. And it was interesting. I saw more pets than people. Sydney is covered with, you know, Lost.
Yeah.
My dear little Daisy or the pet names. And I started to think, that's really sad. But what I also was researching was how many of the indigenous bird types had been lost over the past 60 years. Hang on, there are no signs saying lost grey fantail or lost thornbill or lost whipbird, which is a bird I grew up with. So I did a series of whipbirds, which were collaged images of suburbia in the shape of a whipbird, which has a very distinctive long tail. So the idea of what wasn't there became very important.
Yeah.
And we've talked a little earlier about environment and progress, and increasingly I'm becoming interested in the idea of the walk subtly, perhaps sometimes a little more blatantly, drawing attention to what is being lost and the fact that this century, as we all know, has been a century of incredible progress but unbelievable loss. And I'm really interested in ways that walking can bring that to people's minds increasingly.
Tell us a bit of how you became a photographer. How's it all worked out, and what kind of photography were you doing?
I guess I began as a street photographer. I didn't really understand what that meant. I thought everyone just wandered around with a camera, and hence walking has always been integral to my practice, if you call it that. And I snapped a lot of material in London, and I thought I took some good images, but it wasn't until I came back to Sydney in the early 1990s that the kind of profundity that photography offered became more evident to me. And for instance, I started doing a series of out-of-focus landscapes of Sydney suburb, and they have a kind of a pool-like colouring so that you're aware perhaps of the memory of a place but not the specifics of a place. And I really love the fact that photography in an analogue fashion is always of somewhere, but by abstracting it, by actually unfocusing it in camera, I found that captured a lot more for me of a returned Sydney cider. So I began to think how photography could evoke memory. And I think my work became increasingly abstract as a basis for that. I also was a late bloomer in the sense of I didn't go to art college till I was 32.
Mm-hmm.
I did a media degree when I first left school. So it was a great joy to go back at Sydney College of the Arts. I ended up doing 4 degrees there, but I did end up teaching there as well, which was great. And the whole artistic history of photography and place and recording one's presence or absence in the landscape then became things that I learned over 10 years. So I'm informed by all sorts of other photographers. Uta Barth, for instance, German photographer who's worked with evocations of memory and place, but also a whole raft of independent filmmakers, people like Stan Brakhage, experimentations with celluloid. Paul Winkler, a remarkable Sydney-based experimental filmmaker, for want of a better word, who made his most beautiful collages of Sydney. So I found all that material very exciting, and researching the history of artists, of course, in Australia, doing work about the landscape and their place in it. Also a lot of Aboriginal work, which has been very strong in the last 40,000 years.
Because you did tell me that you... Were you living in Deptford or New Cross? But what I was going to say was you weren't studying photography at Goldsmiths or something.
No, I wasn't. I was working at the British Film Institute. That was my day job. And I was roaming the streets on the weekend.
Okay, so what's the future for David Watson? Yeah, you're no longer an academic.
No, I'm not. And I really only grazed that world. Yeah. It's a world that I haven't really sought to be part of. I enjoyed it for a few years. But no, I'm much more interested in being a wild card on the edges. But influenced by it and hopefully with some knowledge of it. I meant to just mention before that so many British artists have also given me great joy and inspiration. For instance, Patrick Keeler's films, particularly London and Robinson in Space. But also, of course, authors like Ian Sinclair and old Max Sebald, who spent a lot of time living here. So writing has been a huge part of my project, and I guess I regard myself as much as a writer, as a visual artist, but I am keen on pursuing more writing and more visual art. I'm working with a group of environmentally inflected artists, if that's possible. People who at the moment are particularly, 9 of us, Sydney-based largely, who are concerned about the ravages of coal, particularly in Australia, where our contribution to global warming is very high. We're punching way above our weight. I think we've got the largest footprint of CO2 on Earth. And we also have a Prime Minister at the moment who is intent on perpetuating the lie that coal is good for humanity. Mm-hmm. So we think the time is right for artists to do some good activism. And although it's dispiriting at times, I think in crisis lies opportunity. And a group of artists that I'm working with, we have a show coming up in regional New South Wales about the whole phenomenon of non-violent direct action, lock-ons, and there's some very interesting work being done. Most recently, and some of your listeners may be rugby union fans, I'm not sure, by the ex-Wallaby captain, David Pocock, who locked himself on only 2 weeks ago, to the horror of some in the establishment, I'm sure. Some of whom have probably got their fingers in the coal industry. But that his photograph on the front page of the Sydney Morning Herald was incredibly important to this campaign to stop some of the major perpetrators like Rio Tinto, like Whitehaven, who are continuing their activities unabated with the knowledge that 97% of scientists say they must stop. And as David Suzuki suggests, it's a total abrogation of their human responsibility. So I think artists can assist with this message getting out. And we've held several exhibitions, one called Leave It in the Ground last year, referencing coal, of course, which touched a number of nerves and continues to draw support around Australia. So we hope to be exhibiting on the issue of fossil fuels. And we hope we can make a tiny difference.
And maybe walking will be a part of that.
There are several plans, and I'm not sure which one's going to get up first.
Yeah.
My initial idea was that I would follow the power lines from my own power board, Roselle, where I live with my family, in Sydney, to the Hunter Valley, which is about 170 miles north, which is where most of the coal which generates my electricity is mined. And a year and a half ago when I wrote an article to that effect, I felt the public just didn't have a clue about where their power came from. Therefore, they didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
But in the last 18 months, there's been such a flurry of upset, protests, media coverage, that I think people perhaps do now know where their power comes from, because it's hardly ever off the front pages. So I'm not sure that project needs to be done.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking that there may be other ways that walking can encircle mines, for instance, perhaps.
Mm-hmm.
Draw attention to invisible corporate actions. So yes, the thrust in Australia at the moment is to stop any new coal mines. And if we can do something via walking, via activism, involving walking, I'm very keen to be involved with that. So perhaps that is the future.
Put you on the spot.
Yeah.
Think of a couple of walks that you'd like to recommend. It could be just a walk through the suburbs back to your home, your birthplace.
Well, I guess having done that walk, and I didn't mention to you that I in fact completed the pilgrimage and the family home. I mentioned my parents were ageing and were quite ill when I got there, and subsequently both of them died about a year after. And being an only child, we sold the family home and that was it. So I thought, well, that's a funny walk. I've got to the end. Here I am in Dundas, where I don't really want to be because I live 20 kilometres to the east. How do I get home? And I looked down from the escarpment and there was the Parramatta River, and I'm an inveterate daily swimmer in the Sydney Harbour. Oh, that's it. Walking on water. I'll swim home. Being an Antipodean, you know, Hawaiian kind of person, that seemed a very South Seas Aboriginal way to complete the pilgrimage.
You chose to swim downstream, I take it.
Well, it depends on the tide. It's all tidal.
Okay.
But in fact, without even realising it, I lucked into being with the tide, and it did make quite a difference, even in the sluggish mangrove-lined upper reaches of the Parramatta River, which I have to say were a little trepidatious.
So you're wearing a wetsuit for this trip?
No, I was just wearing a pair of Speedos.
And how long did that take you?
It was a 14-kilometre swim, and I did it over four separate days in April 2011. And it was a joyous thing to do. It's rarely done in Sydney Harbour, and that was another reason I wanted to do it, because there's kind of fear of Sydney Harbour. People will swim in Bondi, which is 3 kilometres away, very happily, or in any of the other 30 beaches in Sydney, but for some strange reason, they won't go swimming in Sydney Harbour. So I thought, okay, well, that's a fear that I'd like to examine.
Mm.
Also, the reason for going down the river was because along the river are many remediated sites that are being fixed up by communities, and I felt that it was worth drawing attention to the fact that, yes, we've done a lot of damage with all this progress, but in fact, in the last 10 years, there's been a lot of really good bush care work, a lot of community interest in planting original indigenous species, revegetating, you know, headlands which were industrial wastelands, mm-hmm. and it's incredible how quickly nature comes back. So I also wanted to draw attention to that, and that seemed like a hopeful way to complete a pilgrimage.
Okay, so one walk is to walk back to your home and then find your nearest river and swim down it. So we're walking and swimming
so
back.
Yes, I'd recommend, I prefer not to recommend a particular walk.
Okay.
I would prefer to recommend that each and every one of us looks at where they live and perhaps where their parents live and perhaps where their children live in a more coherent and relaxed way, and to pace it out at your will.
You've been listening to Talking Walking, brought to you by Rethinking Cities and the Museum of Walking. In this episode, you've heard from David Watson. If you have any views on this interview or any walking issues, we would love to hear from you. Just follow the links on the Talking Walking website. We look forward to having you along for future episodes of Talking Walking. Written, recorded and produced by Andrew Stuck of Rethinking Cities Limited, our artwork is designed by Ian Martin of Aardvark Graphics, and the music is composed by Simon Sanders of Easytronic.